Information and Communication Design, Information and Communication Technology. This is a recording of an interview made on behalf of the Knowledge, Information, Data and Metadata Project of the British Computer Society. The interviewer, Conrad Taylor, is talking to Professor David Sless of the Communication Research Institute based in Australia. David is also a visiting Professor of Information Design at the University of Coventry and writes on design methodology and the philosophical underpinnings of human communication. David, I think of you as a kind of a practical philosopher within the world of information design. And within the information design community, you're quite well known as somebody who tackles some of the bigger questions, if you like, at a more generalized level. You're about to speak at an information design conference, as you often do. Now, that information word is one that has us scratching our heads within the information and communication technology field. And communication is a word that you also use in one of your titles because you have a leading role within the Communication Research Institute. So I wondered if you had any particular take on what these words information and communication mean and where they interface.
Thanks very much for that introduction, Conrad. I'm very impressed with it. The word I take out of it that to me is the most valuable and important one is the word practical. Whatever I'm doing, my concerns are very practical concerns, even when I'm writing what other people would recognise clearly as philosophy. It's a very practical pursuit. Philosophy, in my view, is just one of our most advanced forms of thinking about the practical business of everyday living. So I don't elevate it to something obscure or mysterious or esoteric. It's about trying to deal with everyday things. When we come to words like communication and information, one of the big problems one has is that their meanings are always defined in relation to quite specific contexts. Of course, we most readily recognise their usage in relation to technology, but we also recognise their usage in relation to what people do. And there is often a radical difference between these two. I tend to think, when I think about so-called information technologies or communication technologies, I think more about plumbing than I do about communication and information. I think these systems are vast systems for digital plumbing. Now, there's a long gap between plumbing, if you like, and acts of personal hygiene, like washing your hands. Plumbers are employed to make sure that the taps flow with water, that the waste gets taken away, and that when you switch the tap on and off, it works. They don't have a major responsibility for my personal hygiene. So the fact that we go around and wash our hands is not something that greatly concerns plumbers, but obviously without the plumbers, we couldn't do it.
Okay, but looking at this from the point of view of, let's say, electronic publishing, I would say that how you're defining technology as the conduit and the method for delivery, there are those of us who'd regard technology as being something that actually is more aligned to meaning. So, for example, if you are creating a structured document in a system like SGML, or you're designing how a database will be structured and what fields it should have and how they should relate to each other, these are technical issues, but they're also issues that are not just about plumbing, but about how we organise the world.
Indeed. I think, though, the reason for my metaphor is to distinguish between two types of activities, one of which goes on inside the machine and is to do with the functioning of the machine.
Yes.
The other is to do with the interaction between the machine and people who use it.
Right.
And when information is organized, whether it's through XML or through documents that may be generated electronically or printed out in some way, that only becomes information and communication from my point of view when it's part of this process of interaction. Up until that point, it's simply a system of delivery.
Okay.
And I think the issue is the number of ways of thinking about this may be more usefully, one of which people who construct documents are in a sense a bit like choreographers.
Mm-hmm.
They are creating a space in which a dance can occur. And they are, to some extent, providing steps that the dancers can go through.
Mm.
But the dance itself has to be done by people, and it's to do with people interacting with the information that's in front of them and what they then do with it. So that it's distinguishing, if you like, between the choreography and the dance.
That's an odd coincidence, because somebody I was just thinking about there was Liz Orner, who mm-hmm. we both know and who's mad keen on dancing.
Indeed.
And Liz, in some of her recent books, uses the word information contextualized in a phrase like an information product. And I think that she has a model whereby mm-hmm. we discover things, or we have knowledge in our head. Things become information when we package them into information products, which are a way of transferring what's in our heads over to somebody else, which doesn't mean she's not making a claim that therefore automatically, like, what's it called, the Nuremberg funnel effect, just gets poured into your head. It needs to be interpreted.
Yes.
But that she uses the word information in the context of things packaged data that's communicated to another person. Mm. And in that context, I suppose, you would understand information design as being the art of designing such packages so as to maximize the ability to communicate as clearly as possible?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I think there are really quite difficult issues around notions of clarity. A lot of what we're concerned with is using material to accomplish some sort of action.
Yes.
We read documents in order to gain a better insight into something, or to find out what we have to do in order to achieve something, and so on.
Yes.
We're very much, I think, task orientated.
Yes.
And the degree to which that has anything to do with really quite problematic philosophical notions like understanding,
mm-hmm.
which I know is often used as the end point, you know, what we're doing is creating some information so that people can understand X.
Yes.
I think that's deeply problematic and in the end not terribly useful, because as much as anything, I don't know whether you understand X.
Okay.
And I don't know of any methodology that even gets me close to that, let alone overcoming all the problems of definition of what might constitute understanding in the first place.
Sounds like a quasi-Cartesian scepticism.
Well, it is, in a way. Yeah. It is.
And so when, I can't remember the woman's name, who writes about sense-making.
Yes.
I remember you and I were at a, I think it might have been at Pittsburgh, actually.
Yeah.
Someone was talking about
sense-making,
and it was something about which you felt deeply sceptical.
I do feel sceptical about that, because I think sense-making, insofar that it's a useful idea, implies a kind of end point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have now made sense of this.
Mm.
Whereas, in fact,
I don't think that the people who use that term use it that way. I think they see it as some sort of bricolage whereby we're constantly deconstructing our sense of what makes sense in the world and adding to it.
Maybe so. The human condition, though, is by and large a condition of nonsense. That is, a condition where we go around actually not understanding anything very much.
Mm.
And there are little moments when we say, oh, yes, I think I understand that. That makes sense to me. And it does, provisionally and for a moment. And then, of course, the incomprehension, the nonsense, continues. So I think to see sense-making in some sense as an objective, an outcome, is not terribly useful, because it's too ephemeral. And Anyway, there is no way of directly finding out whether people have made sense of something. The only way you know whether people have made sense of something is by the actions they perform. You can talk quite directly about the actions people can perform.
Yes.
Without talking about notions of sense-making, understanding. In other words, you don't need that chain of intervening, as it were, mentalistic notion. Can they do X?
Mm.
If they can do X, then that's been successful. If they can't do X for some reason, then it's back to the drawing board.
Okay.
And that's a much easier way, and it prevents us all from being amateur psychologists.
Okay, well, coming back now, saying to a narrower domain, one of the things that people might want to achieve is that they might want to insure their car, or they might want to order some food online, or they want to know what the level of their bank account is, or
yes,
that sort of thing. Within the ICT community, there's arisen concern recently about information and data quality, and I think a lot of that is seen as being the responsibility of the people running the technology to make sure that things are verified and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it seems to me that a missing awareness is that normally this information is gathered through some sort of form, which could be electronic, but it's often a piece of paper. Like I'm reapplying for a passport at the moment,
mm-hmm,
so I've got to fill out this fairly complicated
mm-hmm
thing. And then you get statements that come back. And a lot of information design practices make a lot of their money out of helping governments and businesses and so on to design these things for what we might call clarity of communication between the corporation and the individual. Or as I know you find it amusing that some taxation departments call us customers.
clients, actually.
Clients, okay. But do you have any comment about the relationship between, for instance, database management and this kind of field that I know you've been involved with for years and years,
sure,
in forms
sure
design and statement design?
Well, look, the old adage that garbage in, garbage out is the case with computers is still very true in this area.
Mm.
If you are collecting data from people, then obviously the vehicle through which you are doing it, whether it's paper form or an electronic form, becomes a critical link in the process. And this is where the notion of, if you like, managing the choreography, the dance that
yes
occurs. So when someone is sitting down in front of a form, what is important at that moment is what is going on between them and the form.
Right, okay.
That's the critical thing. Now, getting that right is what information designers specialise in doing, making sure that people do provide the information that has been asked for, that the questions are going to lead them to provide information which is going to be useful, and so on and so forth.
Okay.
And so that's a vital part of it. So if you think about that, the really critical bit there is not the person so much, not the electronics behind this process, but actually all going on at that interface between the person and the system. And that is, as you say, usually through some kind of form. So the design of that is absolutely critical. And getting that right is very important.
Okay. A lot of our audience actually won't be aware of the practices that we do in information design, which are partly to do with how we write things, how we apply typography, how we use colour, those sorts of things, together with the research methodologies that we use. So could you explain a little for people about typically what one would do in order to improve a form?
Yeah.
And how would you know that you had actually improved a form? You know, what sort of effect on the business or government department?
Okay. We've done a lot of work in that, as you said, and we've published quite a number of case histories in this. I think the most useful case history in this regard is the one we published way back in about 1990 in Information Design Journal, which was to do with improving productivity in the insurance industry.
Yes.
And it was all about how you take a very poor quality form, which is still sadly the norm, and turn it into something which is useful. And at the same time, what we did as part of that is to show how you measure at each stage what actually is happening, and how you then at the end of the day can say, as we could in that project, that the company had saved so many millions of dollars as a consequence of doing this in terms of improved productivity and, of course, in terms of increased sales and so on.
How's the productivity improved? You mean that, for instance, there were fewer mistakes on forms that need
to be
followed up?
That's right. To give you the figures on that, when we started out, and typically in a project of this type, it would go through something like seven stages. The first one of which is what we would call scoping. And most people in IT or any other type of system design area would know about that.
Yes.
That's where you determine what the needs are, what the issues are you have to deal with, what the constraints are, and so on and so forth. What we also do at that stage is something that is not frequently done, but which we've found is actually one of the most important parts of a project. And that is we do what we call benchmarking.
Right.
When we get invited into an organization, it's usually because the fact that they have a dysfunctional system has become apparent to senior management.
Right.
And so they want us to change it. Now, the fact of the matter is that no system, or at least very few systems, are totally dysfunctional. Many of them, simply through the process of evolution and adjustment, have actually achieved some degree of workability. And it's very important at that stage to actually measure exactly what is working at that stage.
Okay.
So typically with forms, what you would do is measure the number of errors that occur on forms. Then if it's a paper form, for example, the errors are much more visible.
Yes.
And that results in reverse workflows. That is, instead of an application going forward, it has to go back to the applicant to provide more information and so on and so forth. That kind of reverse workflow leads to huge problems of lost productivity, because you can't take the thing straight the way through, has to go back and then come back in, and all of those kind of things. Similar things do happen electronically, but in electronic systems, the problems are slightly of a different order.
Yes.
But it's nonetheless the same principle. So if we take, for example, the case history I mentioned before, we took a sample of forms, 200 forms, across the full range of forms in the organization, and we discovered in this sample of 200 forms, 1,470 errors. That worked out, I think, if I remember, something like 7 errors per form.
Okay, these are 200 examples of a particular form.
Yes.
Okay, yes. I get you. Okay.
Yeah. Filled in this case, they were applications for investment insurance products.
Right.
Endowment insurance, those kind of things. And so these were coming into the office, and they were going straight back out. By the way, they weren't going back to the clients, to the public, they were going back to the agents, and it was the agents who were filling in these forms incorrectly.
Okay, so it wasn't the public who had...
No. Oh, no, if you look at it in the context of the public, and you look at government administration in particular, the error rate on forms is equally bad, and it results in massive amounts of increased work for the bureaucracy. Some would even say it's a make-work scheme.
Okay, so how do you improve that situation?
Well, once you've got those measurements, the other thing we would do at that stage is actually watch people fill out the existing form.
You get volunteers to come in and set them a task. Rather like in HCI, you would get an intermediate prototype and say, well, could you discover the information about such and such in this product?
And the tasks we would set them would be those that we have agreed with all the stakeholders are the important tasks.
Okay.
So in other words, we couldn't ask everything,
yeah,
but we would ask somewhere in the region of 15 to 20 questions,
yeah,
which would be basically, can you find where to send this form to? Which questions that you've filled in so far did you have a problem with?
Yes.
And often, because we're sitting there watching them do it, we can see this unfolding.
Okay.
You know,
I've been involved in videoing some sessions like that.
Yeah, yeah. And so by the time we've done that data collection on errors, mm-hmm, and then what we would call diagnostic testing, where, and we call it diagnostic testing because what we're actually doing is we're looking for symptoms of pathology.
Right.
Pathology in this case is people's the symptoms rather, are people's inappropriate use of the form.
Right.
The cause of this pathology is the document.
Right.
So it's a sick document, not a sick person that
right,
we're looking at.
Okay.
And this is actually very, very important because it determines how you then proceed.
Yes.
Because if you think the people are sick, then you have to treat the people.
Sure.
And if you think the document is sick...
It also defines how you, the etiquette of the testing meeting, isn't
absolutely,
it?
That
you have to tell
absolutely,
people, look, we're not testing you, we're testing this document.
That's right. And we actually explain to them that what we're looking for is faults.
Yeah.
That we're not interested in whether this thing works, if it works, all well and good. But really what we want to do is to find out what's wrong with it so we can fix it.
Yeah.
So
now, within the medical field of pathology, of course, there are several sicknesses that we kind of recognise.
Absolutely.
Because we see repeated patterns.
That's
what sort
right,
of repeated patterns do you notice in things like, for example, bad forms design?
In forms design, among the most common problems are that people do not read instructions.
Right.
If you give people a form, not surprisingly, they regard it not as a reading task, but as a form-filling task.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a long list of instructions at the front of the form, we can virtually guarantee that these will not be read.
Right.
The only way you will get people to read instructions, actually, is if you convert them into questions that, to which they have to provide answers.
Okay.
And because that's what they're doing, they're filling in a form.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of techniques you can use to improve that situation, but the reading of instructions is probably the weakest thing on forms. And by the way, this is even more noticeable on electronic forms. You know, and you can have instructions right next to the box, right next to the data field, and people go straight to the data field and ignore the instructions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the issues. The other issue that is very frequently a problem is that people miss fields.
They skip them, they accidentally.
Skip, yes, they just don't notice them being there.
Some forms, though, have conditional routes through them,
oh,
don't
yes,
they? And I think
yes,
that can cause a problem.
But the reason why we've introduced in some forms conditional routes is precisely to deal with that type of problem.
Yes.
But you have to do those conditional things properly, otherwise people do end up in the wrong spot.
Conceivably a little easier to do with electronic forms because fields that people don't need to fill in simply don't appear.
That's correct. Some of those things are easier to deal with.
What about vocabulary issues, or I might call them really properly terminology issues, because sometimes an organisation uses a terminology about its practice which the people that it's communicating with through this interface wouldn't recognise as being the term that they would use. Whether you call it rubbish or refuse, there must
yeah,
be much more sophisticated
yeah,
things like that. Some people don't know what you mean if you say spouse. That's
yeah,
thing,
that's right. And that's why this type of diagnostic testing is very important, because you can use that as an opportunity to pick up these sort of problems.
Mm.
And sometimes we're talking about words that have, you know, you would regard them as plain English words, like the word type.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you ask someone, what type of car do you have?
Mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily going to elicit the answer that the insurance company want.
Yes, they might want to know if it's a pickup, whereas somebody might put Nissan.
That's right, that's right. So even a simple word like type in the wrong context is going to elicit an inappropriate response.
Yes.
And there, I think, is where the only way you overcome these problems to do with specific contextual matters is actually to test the form.
Yes.
If you don't do that. And of course, because these errors are very common types of errors, these are the sort of things you can pick up in the diagnostic testing before you start doing a redesign. So we would always start off, as I say, by doing very elaborate scoping phase, probably taking up sometimes about a third of the project. Then we would do this benchmarking. Only once we have done that would we then move on to the development of a new prototype. Following the development of a first prototype, which is basically looking to try and achieve all of the performance requirements that we agreed in the scoping stage with the stakeholders. We then basically repeat the diagnostic testing that we used at the benchmarking stage on the new prototype.
And see if there's an improvement.
And that's right. Yeah. And what we're looking for is actually the disappearance of the pathology.
Right.
So very much like a clinician, you know, you give a patient a pill and you invite them back a week later. And
you find
see
the blood pressure's still gone down, but the triglycerides are still high.
That's right. Yeah. And so you have to apply an extra treatment. Yeah. And so it goes on until you achieve, you know, a symptom-free patient, or at least one who's under control.
I think symptom-free patients tend to be dead.
Yes. Anyway, so it is very much like a clinical practice, and I think it has more affinity with clinical practice than it does, say, with what's usually called usability testing.
Really?
Much more so.
Or do you think that that's because there's a body, the body of practice which calls itself usability testing has got things to learn? Or do you think it's just applying to different things? Because for me, there seem to be a great deal of similarity between what's involved in what, in our context, we call HCI, human-computer interaction, and what we do in information design. But you're thinking that there's a divergence.
I think there is a divergence. Partly it's to do with the fact that the way the methods are pursued by information designers, the diagnostic testing, is done by designers with...
Who are producers. Who are craft producers.
Yes. It's done by designers, and it's done in order to answer design questions.
Yes.
HCI professionals tend to do their work and then pass on their findings maybe to a design team.
Oh, so you're saying that it's a personnel issue, the fact that there's a segmentation of work.
Yes, indeed.
So would you be pointing the finger at HCI as a practice and suggesting that it needs to integrate more closely with those who are the producers?
Well, I think people in HCI have more recently come to this view, but they still have some difficulty in doing that. Just to give you an example, when a designer looks at some information and someone is getting lost, let us say, they can't find what they're looking for, they see it as a problem of typographical hierarchy, of direction giving. In other words, they see it within the frame of what you can do technically as a designer to enhance something, so that it becomes more visible, so that its structure is manifest. A whole range of things that a designer knows how to use in order to make things of a design nature improve. HCI person doesn't have those craft skills.
Which in their case might involve C++ programming or something like that.
Yes, or it might involve a knowledge of cognitive science.
Okay, yes.
And that's fine, but it doesn't tell the designer what to do. It just simply says, here is a description of symptoms. Whereas the designer can actually look at this process and without having to then go through an intermediary process of providing a report and interpreting that report and so on, go directly to the issue. It becomes not only more useful and practical, it's actually more economic.
Yes. There are times when I've heard you use the word design in what feels to me like a more general context. And I'm also reminded that a wee while back you said that whereas the century we've just escaped from, the 20th, was largely dominated in philosophy by a philosophy of language, that we were moving into an era in which hopefully the philosophy of design would become more important. Well, it felt to me the way you said that as if design is a way of living in the world and constructing the world together with the other people we live with in the world and the other organisms. Basically a kind of a practical applied method of problem solving within the world. Yeah. And in that sense, there seems to be a lot of commonality between the methodologies. I mean, you know, whatever our problems, we should always scope, we should always benchmark, indeed, we should always do our testing, we should do rapid prototyping, we should figure out whether we've actually improved things and take responsibility for them. So I was wondering if you wanted to expand a bit about that more, what you mean by design philosophy. And recently, I mean, I know you're preparing a paper at the moment called Designing Philosophy, which is a nicely ambiguous use of the phrase.
Yes, indeed. The whole notion that I've been playing with really, in a sense, grows out of the philosophy of language. But a particular variant of that philosophy of language, and the variant is that pursued by Ludwig Wittgenstein.
Yes.
A lot of people know quite well the Wittgenstein, the early Wittgenstein,
the Tractatus.
Mm. Because a lot of what people regard as acceptable methods in science takes as some of its starting points the thinking of Wittgenstein in the Tractatus.
Mm.
The latter Wittgenstein, so we're talking about the period from about the 1930s onwards, is much more difficult for people to engage with for all sorts of reasons, partly because Wittgenstein himself was preoccupied with some very minute problems in the philosophy of mathematics and in the philosophy of language. And it's only by knowing some of the background to that and actually understanding that, that you can actually get directly then into Wittgenstein and say, ah, I see what he is arguing about. The most valuable thing about Wittgenstein is not the specific issues he dealt with in his writing,
but his approach generally.
But his approach, yes. Mm. And he never articulated that approach. He just used it, or if you like, developed it organically as he went. So he never spelt out his methodology.
Mm.
So you have to, in a sense, intuit that by, as it were, retracing some of the steps in his argument. So that makes Wittgenstein quite difficult for people who are not either trained philosophers or have oodles of time and a very open mind,
yes,
to be able to deal with. But the essence of Wittgenstein's method is incredibly simple and very easy to state. First of all, he said that if you want to understand something about the meaning of a word or an idea, look at the context in which it is used and how it is used in that context.
Mm-hmm.
And that resonates incredibly well with all the things I've been
saying exactly.
About information and information design. And one of the things that came out of this, which people are still debating, is the view that many of the traditional problems of philosophy are actually not problems at all. They are simply to do with the fact of people taking words out of context, using them in other contexts, and not using them properly, or using them in ways which look odd.
Mm.
The particular words he was concerned with were words philosophers use, like knowledge,
mm-hmm,
perception, how we see things, what it is to see. And he spent a lot of time just trying to tease out the everyday common usages of these terms, and then showing that these words work incredibly well for ordinary everyday use. It's only when you take them out of context that they stop working, and that we then end up with what we think of as philosophical problems. Now, what we get from Wittgenstein is the idea that language is something we have invented for particular uses, and we have created it. Now, it's just a step away from that to saying that language is something we have designed.
Okay. Now, how does that parallel with the view that many people would have that mathematical truths are only true because it's an artificial field that we've created?
Yes. That's essentially Wittgenstein's position. He would say that so-called mathematical truths are, in fact, highly formalized types of language games, as he called them.
Yes.
And that if you want to play that game, you have to play by the rules of that game. And that's what gives us 2 plus 2 equals 4.
But of course, the way that we apply these correspondences in the real world is that we have 2 apples and we have 2 oranges, and that equals 4 fruit. But it seems to be a rather more messy entanglement between the game of language and the correspondence that it's supposed to have with the external world.
Well, that was...
Where semiotics kind of...
Yeah, that's the difference between the early and the late Wittgenstein. In Wittgenstein's early work, he actually had this notion of language as a kind of correspondence to reality.
Yes, yeah, so almost like Plato to some extent.
But certainly the idea that somehow there were facts in the world and you had language which described
those, mapped across to
that. That's right.
Yes.
He began to realise in the 1930s that really that wasn't going to work. And so a lot of his actual work in the latter part of his life was actually a struggle with his own earlier work.
Yes.
Again, another reason why his work
difficult
is difficult to understand.
Yes.
The issue, though, is if you say, well, look, language is something we have made.
Yes.
And, of course, we're still struggling with the current prototype of it.
Yes.
Which we are iteratively changing as we go, because we find new uses we want to make, new inflections, new things we want to do with language. So language is, if you like, albeit non-material, is one of the things we've created in the world for dealing with the world.
Yes, yes.
It's an extension then to say, well, that's what motor cars are. So if we design motor cars, we're creating something to interact with the world. So that there is a similarity then between language at the level of something we have made and the motor car as something we have made. And that, of course, goes for all the other things. I mean, we're sitting here in a room and there is nothing we can look at in this room that we haven't as human beings made. So that we live in a made world, and therefore the issue of how we come to terms with that world and how we move forward in that world is a design question.
I can see you as the sort of person that might get thrown out of libraries, actually, because there's a lot of discussion that goes on about categorization and taxonomies and the organization of knowledge.
Yes.
Words tend to be the tools that we use to do that.
Indeed.
We apply metadata and that sort of thing.
Indeed.
In the medical field, for instance, we've got structured headings, we've got standard nomenclatures, that sort of thing. And there are lots of people that are very keen on being able to structure and organize reality and even construct what, because they love stealing from philosophers, what they call ontologies, in order that computers might handle more information automatically, what they talk about, the semantic web.
Yeah.
And yet the view you're putting forward, which seems quite a common sense one, that meanings are fluid and people use them in different ways, and something that is now described as cool doesn't necessarily have a temperature. This is a tricky issue for the organisation of knowledge and information and manipulating it within systems.
Well, I think it's only tricky if you want to define things in terms of absolutes. If what you're doing, and most engagements with professional languages are doing this, is they're working in areas where they need considerable degree of precision.
Okay, so that's that is a context that we define and we allow to happen.
Absolutely, and it's absolutely essential. You cannot have multiple meanings and multiple usages of languages in specialist areas which are aiming at some degree of precision and distinct categories, which are functional categories.
Yes.
The problem only arises when the categories do not prove functional. And very often taking specialist terminology and putting it into a non-specialist context.
It might be a local government website that uses terms that make sense to the social services department, but not to the general public.
I was recently doing some testing on a website for a utility, and one of the questions we asked was, what does this company do? And no one could tell us. Now, what they did was they sold electricity, gas, and a few other types of things.
Right.
That was not apparent because they had structured their website around their perception of the segments of the market they were trying to reach. So it had private, business etc., etc. And when they talked about services, the public thought in terms of, you know, coming and fixing things, you know, providing you with a service of some sort. They didn't see this as electricity, gas, etc. So there's an example, not a very complex professional set of categorizations, but an inappropriate one in a particular context. That's an example of where you get a mismatch between language used in one context and language used in another. Now, neither of these contexts are more or less real than the other. They're just more or less appropriate
and
to
so
particular
you really need to understand the context.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, your approach comes across in many ways as quite a pragmatic one, but then the word pragmatics has a particular meaning within this context, because you're talking about, you regard pragmatics as almost like the queen of the linguistic sciences compared to semantics and syntactics.
Well, this would be something of interest, I think, to people in the computing area. If you look at most textbooks on programming languages, they talk about semantics and syntactics of a language.
Yes.
Semantics being the things that particular language represents, and syntactics being the rules by which you put various statements or instructions.
The grammar, if you like.
The grammar,
okay.
Together. So those two terms, semantics and syntactics, have quite a specific meaning within computing. Now, the origin of those two terms, and it's very important to recognize this, is in a theory about language. And it's a theory about language which says, look, there are basically three things that we can study in language.
Yes.
One of which is syntactics, the grammatical rules.
Right.
The other is semantics, that is what things like words mean.
Yes.
And then we have a third area, which is called pragmatics, and that is how the language is used. In classical linguistic theory, each of these is regarded as having an equal status. It turns out, though, when you look at the vast majority of studies in linguistics, that the focus is on semantics and on syntactics. And similarly, you find this, of course, in computing.
And the semantics also gets independently developed through semiotics, presumably. That's an extension of...
Yes. Although semiotics is a term that tends to confuse people.
Okay. And it stretches so beyond language, too.
So let's sidestep that.
I withdraw my red herring.
That's okay. Life is very short, really.
Right.
And... The main thing to note in all of this is that when you say, well, how do we know about these things?
Mm.
How do we know about syntactics and semantics?
Well, obviously from examples in ordinary life.
That is right, through pragmatics.
Mm.
In other words, we only know about language, we only know about grammar through usage.
Mm.
We only know about the meaning of words through usage.
Mm.
So we've had a very odd distortion going on in linguistics over the last century, in which the objects of study, that is semantics and syntactics, which are regarded by many as the most important aspects of language, are only studied through pragmatics, and we only know about them through pragmatics.
Right.
And so, really, in a sense, actually all we have is pragmatics.
Is pragmatics.
We don't have the other two. We, if you like, invent the other two.
Are there formalisms that arise from,
that's right,
from an understanding of pragmatics?
And sometimes very useful formalisms, because we can use those formalisms to teach people how to use language.
Right. I have a sneaking feeling that Bakhtin comes in here somewhere. You recommended me to read Bakhtin some years back, I think as a form of punishment. But his concern was very much with pragmatics, was it not?
It was. Again, total different terminology and so on. So he was essentially concerned with literary criticism. He wasn't concerned so much with...
with daily use of language.
Yeah, he was very much concerned with literary criticism. And what preoccupied him was actually what preoccupied me. It's, if you like, the dialogue or the dance that goes on between the reader and the text. And what happens when you take that view, instead of saying, there is a text here, and there is a reader here, but you suddenly start looking at the space in between and what's happening in that space... you discover that actually most of what is happening in that space.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And therefore that becomes a much more interesting place.
Within the Information Design Association and also with the International Institute for Information Design, there have been noises made about trying to raise the profile of information design as a profession.
Mm-hmm.
It's never really taken that step of formalising itself as a profession in the way that, for instance, the British Computer Society, established by Royal Charter, etc., regards itself as a professional association.
Mm.
But we do think of ourselves as professionals, which doesn't just mean that we make money doing it, but that we regard ourselves as having some sort of standpoint vis-a-vis the general public or the public good, you might say.
Mm.
So I wondered if you wanted to close out with some thoughts about the ethics of professionalism in information design and information technology, and where you think that there might be common ground in that.
Okay. I think one of the things that we all started out with back in the 60s and 70s was... two things. One was a quite serious concern with the quality of information that people had to put up with.
Right.
Information from government, gobbledygook, documents that were incredibly badly laid out, the six-point type, which was so obviously obfuscatory. Mm. And yet here we were as citizens supposed to participate in a civil society and not being given the information tools in order to do that effectively.
Mm.
And there are lots of examples of this. One can point at things like the American voting system, which simply disenfranchises people because of its bad information design. But you can think of things like people's entitlement to social security, etc., where people lose entitlements because they simply don't understand the documents that are being sent to them, the letters that are coming out, and so on. And many of us were very deeply concerned about that. And also we were seeing this, of course, in the private sector as well. The video recorder that none of us could work out how to use.
With the 12 flashing constantly.
That's right. Or the mobile phone, or the computer.
Yes.
And, of course, the computer and the issues around that have focused a lot of the attention and energy of information designers on the issue of making information usable.
Yes.
But at the base of this is a common desire among information designers to make information accessible and usable to ordinary people. That, I think, is an underlying thing. The second part of it is one where we believed that by applying certain crafts and skills, we could actually make a difference.
Are you saying a difference to people's ability to understand this information, or you're thinking of an even bigger difference, political difference?
A bigger difference at two levels. One, in terms of the very specifics of enabling people to make sense of their telephone bill,
yes,
making sense of the tax form they had to fill in, making sense of the flickering screen of the computer in front of them. So there was that at at the immediate practical level. But beyond that, I think many information designers regard what they're doing as a contribution to civil society.
Yes.
That there is, if you provide people with information that is usable, you add, even by a small degree, to the overall quality of people's lives and their capacity to meaningfully contribute in a complex society. So I think those notions of egalitarianism, of providing people with information that they needed to use, that was very much part of where many of us started from.
Although, to be a bit contrarian, I think also there were also concerns with helping people to ensure that surface-to-air missiles were delivered efficiently, etc.
Absolutely. We're living in a very interesting time where being nice to people and serving the instruments of capitalism and the war machine and so on somehow happily coincide around information design. And whichever position you take, whether you're a servant of Mammon or a servant of the public.
Or Mars.
Information design seems to be able to make some contribution to all of those, and I think that's one of its great strengths at the moment. Might not always be that case historically, but it is at the moment.
And it has that in parallel with information technology.
Oh, I think so, yes. I think the other thing, though, that drove us, as I said, was a belief at that time that by applying certain techniques, that is, using good practices in typography, in design, use of language which was appropriate for people's needs and so on, all of those things would make a contribution. But at the time, we lacked the evidence to prove this. It was just a very strong set of convictions. Now, I think where we are now is, I think, in quite a different space. First of all, the case that certain techniques work and do lead to significant improvements has been made.
We know this stuff.
We know this stuff. We have evidence. We have the case histories. We have the research and so on. So that there's no longer, if you like, that need to go out and proselytize and say to people, information could be a good way of improving things. We know this to be the case.
Yes.
And many of us receive very high fees from organisations in order to do just that. Where we are now, though, as I say, is a slightly different space. And where we are now, I think, is a position where we can say, well, OK, we can improve things. The question is, by how much? What constitutes an acceptable professional standard of improvement or performance, if you like.
Okay.
And that then lifts the ante, lifts the requirements one has to fulfill to be part of this particular professional
and
group.
And do you see this being formalised to some extent in legislation?
Very much so. We're looking in Australia particularly, but there are examples here in the EU, of legislation which is actually requiring particular standards of performance. So let me give you an example which affects all of us. In Australia, it is now the case that all medicines, which are over-the-counter medicines, and by over-the-counter, I mean the things you can buy in a supermarket or just go into a chemist.
No prescription.
You don't need a prescription for these medicines.
Understood.
And so a large part of the usage of them is basically between you and the packaging.
Yes.
That packaging, that information, has to meet certain standard requirements. It has to be such that any literate consumer, that is someone who claims they are able to read, can find at least 90% of the information that they look for on the pack, and that they can appropriately use at least 90% of the information they find.
Okay.
In other words, we've established a level, a performance level, to which this type of material can, we know, be successful in reaching if you apply professional information design methods to do it. And that's, I think, a rather different notion from simply vaguely saying, well, we're going to improve things. It's what a friend of mine described as a dangling modifier. The word improve, exactly, you know, if you don't say from what to what, then you don't know what you've improved. That, by the way, going back to something I said earlier, is another one of the reasons why benchmarking is so important.
Because you need to know that you've improved and you need to be able to measure the extent to which you have.
That's right.
Yes.
And unless you can do that, any claim at the end of the project that you have improved is actually hollow. In other words, if you haven't got the measurement at the beginning, the measurement at the end is worthless.
Yes.
Sometimes I think, by the way, that makes me the professor of the bleeding obvious, but I think that is the case. And I think as professionals in the area of information design, that's the sort of thing we should be doing on a routine basis. And we know how to do it. So I think the name of the game has changed. I think, though, as I started out by saying, one of the most important things here is that this is all about making the lives of ordinary people easier. It happens along the way, as we've discovered, that some of this leads to massive, and I do mean massive, improvements in product sales.
Yes.
We're about to release some data on this at the conference, which shows an improvement in one particular product line from something like 40% of the market up to 80% of the market.
So there's motivation to the company to do it massively.
Absolutely huge. That's at the level of profits, at the level of improved productivity, which of course is very important in terms of public sector activity. There you can show very significant improvements. That case study I mentioned to do with the insurance documents, that resulted in a 97% improvement in productivity in handling those forms. And when you're talking about millions of forms a year going through an organisation, that's a hell of a lot of improvement.
Finally, one of the things that you've been involved in is the design of systems which produce individual bits of information. So I'm thinking of the work that you did around the labelling of medicines, where you weren't actually designing individual pieces, but a rule-based system that assembled information for people.
Right.
Now, this is an area, I think, where we're also seeing more and more stuff with content management-driven web systems.
Yep.
And that means that the information technologists and the information designers are going to have to learn to work closer together. How organisationally do we help those conversations to happen at a professional level?
Yeah, I think this is absolutely right. And it's something we noticed increasingly in the work we were doing in the 1990s, where, as you say, we, instead of designing a single object for mass production, we were involved in things, and simple things like a telephone bill.
Yes.
Now, two telephone bills are alike. Even if they differ only very slightly one from another, nonetheless, the way you go about designing them. So, for example, you always have to know what the maximum field size is, because the amount of space you leave on the page for information is determined by that field size.
Yes.
Nonetheless, you want someone who owes the company millions of dollars to have a bill that is as equally readable as the person who owes them $20. So that's kind of a very simple thing. Of course, it gets much, much more complex than that when you start building in conditional things. And we first noticed this in insurance documents, where someone would have this particular product or another particular product. You'd need to show all of these together on the one statement. But obviously with the web, this now takes on, particularly as you say, with content management systems, a whole new shape, where you have streams of content being fed into a system which has to somehow
Format on the fly. Poor old insect.
Some of the tools we've got for doing this nowadays are enormously helpful. Things like XML.
XSLT.
Cascading style sheets and so on. These are enormously useful tools in doing this. But in order for those tools to work, you have to design the underlying logic. And the underlying logic has to be one that, when it manifests itself on the screen, is going to make sense to the
people.
User.
Yes.
And that is where we've found developing that type of architecture, if you like. And this is not information architecture as information architects currently think of it, but an entire approach to the structuring of content. Not just what it's labelled, is very much the sort of thing that information designers actually have a lot of skills in, and in some respects in traditional areas, because one of the most common information design problems of a traditional kind is book design.
Yes.
And if, say, you're designing a series of books, say something like the Penguin series of books, which of course Jan Tachiskold developed back in the 50s, I think it was,
the
40s and 50s, that effectively what he designed was a content management system. In other words,
and a meta design.
Designed all the rules by which these type of documents were to be assembled.
Yes.
That, of course, led to a mass production system. Nowadays, it leads to a customized production system where each individual can see, if you like, different content. But the skills in doing that are very much similar to, not the same as, but similar to what is now being required in content management systems.
Yes.
And one could point to other areas as well where information designers have been at the forefront of thinking about this issue, but not just thinking about it, but actually developing practical solutions to it.
And gaining experience. And I suppose, you know, organisations of information technologists often seem to think of themselves as a class apart. But I think what we're discovering within the Kidden project is, for example, that, you know, there are people who know about organising information called librarians who've been doing it for hundreds of years.
That's right.
And that IT would do well to look beyond its boundaries.
Absolutely.
And not to try to swallow up these other professions, but to work collaboratively with them. And I'm looking forward to there being more correspondence and collaboration between people in information management, information technology, and, of course, information design. And maybe this conversation is one step along the way.
Well, I hope so.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.